optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I answer your personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multi-mineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I missed anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, boys and girls. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it is my job to deconstruct world-class performers to tease out the routines, habits, influences, books, etc. that you can use or apply to your own life. And in this episode, I sit down with Edward Norton. At Edward Norton on the Twitters, please say hello to him. Edward is an actor, filmmaker, and activist. Of course, he's been nominated for 3 Academy Awards for his work in Primal Fear, American History X, and Birdman. He has starred in scores of other films, including the iconic Fight Club, The Things You Own, End Up Owning You, The Illusionist, and Moonrise Kingdom, among many, many others. Unbeknownst, however, to many people, Edward is also a serial startup founder. He is a UN ambassador for biodiversity, a massively successful investor, for instance, very early in Uber and perhaps a half a dozen other unicorns, a pilot and deeply involved with wilderness conservation. And as luck would have it, at this exact moment, I am involved with one of his startups, CrowdRise. I have a campaign on there with Johns Hopkins supporting some fascinating psychedelic research. Check it out. It is to address treatment-resistant depression. It's fascinating. So go to crowdrise.com/Tim Ferriss to check it all out. And we have a very wide-ranging conversation. We cover a lot, including his beginnings, what early mentors taught him, some cool Marlon Brando stories, his physical prep for American History X, surfing, favorite books, documentaries, underrated films and filmmakers. That reindeer bell sound is Molly doing a little jig in the background. And there are also some cats and heat outside my apartment for some reason. So excuse the extracurricular sound. Catastrophe of Success would be one of the essays, for instance. His advice to his 20 and 30-year-old self, and much more. One bonus, a book that he recalled, one of his favorites, after we stopped recording, which I wanted to include, is Buddhism Without Beliefs. And without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with the incredible Edward Norton. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I am sitting here looking out at the surfers, and I know we got to start today because you had a session earlier this morning And it seems like surfing is a big part of your life. I know this is maybe an odd place to start, but how long has that been the case?
It's definitely my most positive addiction. I think I started, I actually, my father lived in Indonesia from like 2005 for about 7 years. And I was making a film in China called The Painted Veil. And toward the very end of the film, I got chucked off a horse doing a shot, and I broke my back in three places. Fortunately, didn't hurt my spine at all, just cracked three vertebrae and was really lucky. But my back was like a, an oak table with no articulation in it between my neck and the bottom of my ass. And so I couldn't twist. I couldn't like bend, you know, I was really, really racked and locked up. And when the film ended, my dad had just moved to Indonesia. So I went down there, for a couple months to hang out with him and just, try to recover, a little bit. And I was like swimming and doing yoga and, getting massages and things like that. And there was a surf school on one of the beaches there. And, I'd always wanted to do that and started realizing that it, you know, it forced you into a reversed kind of bowed position that was exactly what I was having trouble doing. And so initially I started doing it, just taking a big padded board and paddling, you know, just to try to increase my endurance at having my back arched. And from there, it just, I got completely hooked on it.
It seems to undo a lot of the sort of posturally induced problems of people who use computers too often, right? I mean, you have this sort of protracted, rounded back, and then when you're forced into that thoracic extension, even for, you know, a half a minute of half an hour of paddling or a few hours of paddling, yeah, it just seems to undo and balance all of that out.
It's great. It's great physically. It's actually great aerobically. It uses muscles in really weird ways. And you have to be nimble and retain your ability to like hop up, you know, and you have to, you know, you're looking at moving water all the time. And, I always say like trying to figure out the micro variations in wave forms and the way they're moving at you and where you should position yourself on them is better than any video game. You know, there's no video game that's more complex than trying to read the nuances of moving water and put yourself in the right place. And it's just, I actually totally not facetious. It's an addiction. I think I have friends who were serious addicts, heroin addicts, you know, really struggled with things, who have replaced that with surfing because it hits parts of the brain, I think, that are completely, you know, it's like dopamine and serotonin all at once, and you come out of it so blissed out and kind of, you know, we were talking about this earlier, like it's like a reboot on your stress, on your crowded mind, on all of it. I just think I should meditate more than I do, except I do surf, and I feel like I get the meditative value out of surfing.
I think the mindfulness aspect of it is, and I'm not a good surfer, although I enjoy surfing poorly, but the fact that the terrain is always changing, like you said, makes it very distinct from something that you might think of as similar, like snowboarding, right? You constantly have to be in a present state, have a present state awareness of where you are relative to your surroundings, where you are relative to other people. It's just it's a necessity that you're paying attention to what's happening in the here and now.
Yeah, it's great. It also, you know, it makes me play hooky more than I do otherwise. I'll suddenly find myself, you know, more able to be confident that I can push other things to the side, mm-hmm. I can't explain it. It recalibrates my sense of urgency around my to-do list. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. It sort of, alleviates the manufactured emergencies somewhat.
Exactly. Yeah.
What other, morning rituals do you have that you find helpful or have you had?
I wish I had better ones is the honest, answer. I think I would benefit from creating more, ritual morning routines that are positive, be it like exercise first thing when I'm not surfing or meditation or, anything that sort of, you know, as a matter of practice, mm-hmm. starts the day in a mindful way or however you want to put it. You know, I too often just let the day begin by opening up the cascade of emails or things I think I'm supposed to do or, you know, it's not the right way to jumpstart the mind. That's a category I should do better on.
So I'm obsessed with routines, of course, different types of habits. Maybe we could, I've wanted to ask you this. I'm actually astonished I haven't asked you this before in our previous conversations, but when you were, getting ready for the role on American History X, what type of training did you do for that? What did your training regimen look like?
It was pretty specific. It was pretty specific to building mass. Like I'm not doing that film created the strangest distortion of perception on me. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but like, it's unbelievable the degree to which that film and the magic of camera and art and black and white photography and all these things made a lot of people think that I was a larger and tougher person than I am. like people who know me, I think almost couldn't believe what was going on after that film because like, you know, I'm like 6 feet tall and I weigh 160 if I'm, you know, not in great shape. Like I have thin wrists. I'm not a big, I'm not naturally big. So, it was a challenge for me to put, you know, that kind of weight on. And, so I just did, you know, many things you'd be more familiar with than almost anybody. I calorie loaded. I a lot of lifting. Mm-hmm. For a long time, for the first portion of it, really just didn't, you know, concern with like leanness at all. Just tried to get muscle mass on. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd had your book back then, but I didn't. Probably would have helped me out. But I, you know, I did my own version of it. Increased diet, increased protein, all that stuff. And then I did it sort of the old fashioned blunt force way, mostly just a lot of, probably much more than had I read your book, sort of, you know, your minimum effort, kind of maxim. I was probably going way beyond the bell curve in terms of effort required to get the result, mm-hmm. but that's what I did. And then as we approached the film, I moved into kind of like, you know, just fat burning mode. And I was doing everything I could to lean out because the camera is a magical thing. It doesn't actually see absolute scale. It really only sees things relative. So you don't know how tall Al Pacino really is unless he's standing next to, you know, Schwarzenegger, like, or whatever, like,
right.
And you don't actually know how big a person is. And lots of people, you know, I had gym rats come up to me and go like, did you weigh $2 on that? Did you weigh $1.90? Like whatever. And I was like, no, I wasn't that big. You know what I mean? But we, But if you get form and definition, the camera sees that. And if you put people around you, which we did very conscientiously, who are smaller. So like the actor guy, Tori, who played the guy in jail, the black guy in jail, who he becomes friends with. Mm-hmm. We cast, he was terrific, but he was also really, really small, and it made me look really, really big. And those things, inflate the perception of how big you've gotten. But, it was hard, but I really enjoyed it.
Was the eating more challenging or the training more challenging?
The eating was more challenging. I had trained. I was, you know, I rode crew in college, and
that was lightweight crew, or
no? I rode heavyweight crew. Yeah.
What is heavyweight? What's the
there's nothing. It's lightweight has a cutoff, but heavyweight doesn't. I was not like a varsity. I rode my freshman year, and I rode my sophomore year. But frankly, I probably should have rode lightweight because I was, you know, at my absolute maxed out. I probably weighed 175 when I was really, really big and strong and 19 years old and everything. And, you know, and the guys who were true, like varsity A class rowers, they were like 215, yeah. You know, guys. Yeah. And it was a whole other thing. But I loved it. I loved it. And so training, I was a runner. I did one kind of ultra marathon kind of thing. I wasn't, training hard wasn't, a new thing for me, but building bulk was.
And was that self-directed, or did you hire someone to help you with that?
I did a lot on my own, but no, I did. I had a guy, whose name is eluding me right now. I never worked with him again or had contact with him again after, but Tony, he was terrific. Yeah. He designed
the protocol for you.
Yeah. Designed it for me. And,
when were you introduced to acting, or how did that come to be? And I did do a fair amount of reading, and for whatever reason, wasn't able to pin it down exactly. I mean, the summer camp came up, but I don't know where things began.
I mean, mostly, you know, my mother was an English teacher. She was a high school English teacher and was a real theater aficionado. Both my parents were theater aficionados and film lovers and stuff like that. And, but they exposed me very early on to theater and plays. And I had a strong pull toward that from the time I was 5 years old. Even I a babysitter of mine went and I signed up, at the theater arts program outside of school that she was involved in. And that's how I got involved in it. And I, you know, I went through ebbs and flows. I loved it. It wasn't like I knew I wanted to be an actor. I just liked doing it, and I loved writing stories. I made up my own comic books, and I made little VHS camcorder films where you use the pause button as your cut. You know what I mean? And, just all that stuff I loved, not exclusively, not in a way where I knew it was my life, as an adult. And then I got really self-conscious about it in high school. Like I went to a public high school. It didn't seem cool to me at all. I was doing my athletics and things, but,
and the athletics were at that time what?
I played tennis. I played baseball. I, played ice hockey.
Where was that?
I ran track in Columbia, Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like half an hour south of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. And who were your first then, mentors in the world of theater acting?
Well, the woman who created this local theater arts school in our community in Columbia, Maryland, her name was Toby Ornstein. And it's crazy to say, but she really was, I still think she's one of the great minds I ever encountered on theater, the craft of theater, the craft of acting. She was not a regional theater hobbyist. She was like, she was my Stella Adler, really, like when I was young, and infused us when we were really young with, I don't know, a sense of seriousness about it and, of, you know, like when you're young and, you know, told us to read and told us to like be erudite on plays. And it was really interesting. And then, I like I said, I got kind of in my teens, I got kind of self-conscious about it. And then, I saw Ian McKellen do a one-man show in Washington, D.C. when I was about 17. And it had such a huge impact on me that I thought, wow, this is something you could actually do as an avocation. You know what I mean? This is something that you can do as an adult. And it's like big and important and meaningful. That's how I felt about it. And then I still didn't really have a notion that I was going to commit myself to that until a couple years after college, even.
A couple years after college. What was your major in college? Or what did
I studied history. I got a degree in history.
Mm-hmm. Did you?
With a focus on Asian studies and languages and stuff.
And if we go back to, and I'm blanking, I apologize. What was her name again? The first woman,
Toby Ornstein.
Toby.
Yeah.
What could you tell a story or give an example of what type of thing she would emphasize when she was working with you guys or any particular?
I mean, I think she just
memories
kinda,
of her.
She was a great director. Great. Mostly I think, you know, I think a lot of people would say that someone in their early life, there's always, if you're lucky, you have someone when you're young who doesn't talk down to you, who speaks to you as a serious person and exhorts you to take something seriously, to take work seriously, you know, and
definitely.
And if a person does that in the right way, you feel elevated. Like as a young person, you feel elevated. You feel like someone's saying to you, hey, you want to be taken seriously? Then take things seriously. Do the work. You know, don't coast, you know, and I'd say that's what she gave. Later, when I was in New York, I had a teacher named Terry Schreiber who ran a terrific theater studio in New York, acting studio in New York. And I've often said about him that the thing I admired most about him was that he was like a pluralist. And by that, I mean, he basically, you know, rejected this notion that has infused, I think, a lot of the training of actors that a methodology is, you know, that like one methodology holds the key to anything. He was like, basically like all of these things are, like what a forehand, a backhand, a volley, a serve are to a tennis player. So that is, you know, the Lee Strasberg method, the Stella Adler imagination focus, the Sandy Meisner, you know, exercises. He basically just said, if you don't get yourself conversant with a lot of shots, you're just not going to be great. Like you're not going to be able to address material with diverse skill sets, as called for, you know what I mean? And I thought that really resonated with me because I was really turned off by, dogma.
Right. Sounds like the Bruce Lee of acting and performance, and the sort of accept what is useful, reject what is useless, and what is uniquely your own type.
Exactly.
Of
exactly.
Approach.
I never thought of it that way, but that's, yeah, I agree.
I am, I've always been, insecure on stage. And I still pace around like a nervous wreck before every time I get up to give a keynote or whatnot. I'm actually taking, I wasn't planning on asking you this, but just came to mind. I'm actually taking my first acting class as an adult at the end of this month. And it's a 3-day, I think it's going to be focused on improv. I don't know exactly what the curriculum is, but what advice would you give? And it's not that I plan on acting per se. I just thought it would be a helpful exercise to get over my fear of doing this type of thing. What advice might you give me?
I always think that one of the most interesting things about the challenge of representing behavior, which is basically what acting is, or representing emotion, representing whatever you want to call it, is that like everybody does this all the time. Like very few people are perpetually speaking in their authentic voice, you know, like the Dalai Lama might. Right, but I bet he's got his moments where he's sort of playing the role of a monk. You know what I mean?
Sure, of course.
As well. And we put on faces, we put on postures, we adapt who we are depending on the circumstances that we're in all the time. And people do it seamlessly all the time and unselfconsciously. And yet the minute that you tell someone that other people are going to watch them do anything, definitely, I think when you put a camera on someone, the effect of self-consciousness is so profound on people's inability to do that which is completely natural to them at most times in their lives. And I almost think like as soon as you put someone on stage or you put a camera on someone, it's like if there's a circle and on one side of the circle is naturalistic, you know, behavior. As soon as you throw someone on stage, it hurls them to the other side of the circle and they immediately become wooden, unnatural. They become unable to, and a lot of that has to do just with tension and a sense of urgency, nerves. You know, I think like the old fight or flight thing, like I think, this is a weird thing to reference, but you know, there's this European show that was like a candid camera type show. It did a lot of things like where they, you know, they were scaring people or setting up a situation of, you know, a ticking suitcase in front of a train station. And what's amazing is how paralysis is actually the most common response. Like people imagine in their minds what their behavior is going to be when presented with certain stimulus or circumstances. But the truth is that people go into a stone cold freeze in many, many situations, you know, and there's a lot of studies on this and like the, you know, the behavior of crowds and all that kind of stuff. Like,
right. The woman
like,
getting stabbed in the street and you have 40 people who staring. All expect someone else to do
right,
something.
Right. And also just because I think it's something deeply biological. Like there's a lot of safety in freezing. You know what I mean? But I think that it's very hard for people to find, a comfort, a relaxed comfort, let alone a sense of pleasure within the idea that they're performing in front of other people. Right. And so they start to, they stop listening, you know, they stop, they start doing what I would call up the middle choices. Like they start painting in the color blue instead of doing the little things that, I can't explain it, that a moment would actually call for. One of the best stories I ever heard about young people in an acting class and you know, the difference between sort of what happens to people typically and what a real authentic kind of genius is that Harry Belafonte talked about being in an acting class with Marlon Brando when they were both like literally like 19 or 20 years old in Greenwich Village. And I think he said that there was what they said was, okay, one person's in his apartment and the other one enters. You're the person who's on your couch in your apartment. The other one enters, scene ensues, you know, just run with it. And all these people were doing all these kind of, you know, sort of forced conversations or trying to create a scenario or something. And supposedly Marlon sat on the couch and started reading a magazine, and whoever it was with him walked in his door and he looked up and jumped up and grabbed the guy by the shirt front and threw him out the door and slammed the door. And everybody was like, what are you doing? He was like, I don't know who that fucking guy is. Like, he just walked into my apartment. Like, it scared the shit out of me. You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, there probably wouldn't be a scene. There probably wouldn't be a conversation. There'd be a like, who are you?
Super awkward confrontation. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, get out. And I, it was the most obvious, true thing that you would do, which is wonder, you know, and
what would the up the middle choice have been in that scenario? Or what is that like? What is another example of that? Because I'd love to get a better understanding.
I don't know. There's a great, you know, I think that, you know, when put it this way, there's an argument and there's something about the writing of a scene that indicates the lines or whatever, indicates stress or it indicates anger. But the thing is that people, so then the up the middle choice is to raise your voice and be angry. But what we all, I think, know on some deep level when we watch people performing who really grab us is that they have an intuition for the choices that reflect the way that those things actually manifest themselves sometimes. Like people who are angry, you know, sometimes laugh. They laugh or they go into silence or they go into slow burn. Like anger doesn't mean volume, but if there's an exclamation point on the end of the sentence in the script, they'll go with that exclamation point as opposed to, there's a film I love called The French Lieutenant's Woman.
The French Lieutenant's Woman.
Yeah. It's Meryl Streep and Jeremy Irons. And, I think it's, I think either Harold Pinter or Tom Stoppard wrote the script. There's a scene toward the end when Jeremy Irons' There's a scene toward the end where Jeremy Irons' character has been looking and looking for Meryl Streep, and he finds her after literally years of searching, and he's become angry, and they go to have a conversation, and he's so angry and overwrought, and he goes to leave and she moves to stop him, and he takes her and sort of in anger and seizes her by the shoulder and sort of pushes her out of the way. And it's one of those things, the camera's set three steps down in a low recessed room, and they're up these three steps. And clearly it was a planned thing where he's throw her and she did a staged fall down sort of right into the camera. And very dramatic. And then he's struck by his violence and he goes to pick her up, and the scene continues on. And if you watch, I remember watching it and suddenly realizing that if you watch it closely, he throws her down and she strikes her head on the floor. You can see that she hits her head on the floor, and you can see if you look carefully that her reaction, she really hits her head, and you can even see it more on Jeremy Irons that he realizes she's struck her head, and his reaction is so alarmed. He is broken totally out of the scene for a moment, runs to her, picks her up. And if you watch it really closely, you can see that he is checking in with her, the actress, for a second, and is about to open his mouth, I think, and just, you know, stop and say, are you okay? And she puts her hand up over his mouth, like as though to say, we're going on. And he realizes that she's still in it, and covers his own mouth with his hand to stop from smiling. And what she does in this moment where you would think, you know, the whole thing is very melodramatic, and she does this laugh in that thing. And I used to watch it because it's just the strangest, most wonderful choice. But it's so true, because she's just like, it's completely absurd. She's just laughing at the absurdity of it all and laughing at these things. And then the scene sort of settles and they go into this gentle conversation and everything. But it's amazing. It's why she's like one of the great, great, greats of all time, because she like, I think it's a completely counterintuitive choice. And it's a great example of like two great actors, and one of them is even about to break out of it, because it's like, something's happened that wasn't supposed to happen, so we should stop. And she's like, no, that's real, you know, something's happened that makes it really, really interesting now, so let's not stop. And it's beautiful.
That sort of level of judgment under duress. It makes, if it's just thinking of a battlefield medic or something like that. I mean, having the presence of mind to put the hand over the mouth. I'll have to watch that. I haven't seen
it. Yeah, it's good. I asked them both about it and got confirmation that that's what happened. So I know I'm not like imagining it.
If you were, say, directing a film and you had the opposite experience, you had a novice actor who was intimidated, say, by the people around them and they were paralyzed for whatever reason or being too robotic, what would you do or say to kind of knock them out of that?
It's tough. It really.
And if it's a bad, it could be a bad question too. I'm out of my depth.
It depends on the situation. I mean, I think the thing that makes that work all interesting so much of the time is that it's a chemistry. There's a chemistry between the people involved that's unique every time. It's the dynamics are unpredictable and fluid and very unique to the people involved. And you really have to find your way like every time. I think one of the things I like about it is that if I walk into those situations feeling confident, I think that I've probably been working too much. You know what I mean? Like I almost think it's almost better to feel, at sea. If it's good, if it's complex, it's a lot of uncertain discovery in the beginning. Mm-hmm. The sense that you're at a loss or you're finding your way and means that you're involved in something worthwhile. I think if you're cruising and it's a thing, then it's probably not that interesting.
You've spent obviously a lot of time honing your own craft. You've spent a lot of time with masters of in many different fields. I'm curious if you have any impressions or recollections of Hicks and Gracie when you were filming The Incredible Hulk. Were you able to spend any time with him or did you?
Yeah, a little bit. Not as much as I would have liked to. It's funny. I started when I was in college, I started studying Aikido. And you know, that was the era. That was exactly when, Hoist Gracie won the first.
Yeah. It must have been like 92 or
UFC,
somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Around there.
Yeah. And maybe I started saying, but I'm not a huge person. I'm tall and everything, but one of the things that drew me to Aikido was that it was one of the first things I experienced where understanding physical leverage really persuaded me that a smaller person could, I don't want to say defend themselves, but that this technique actually worked on a smaller person who was with a larger person. I always felt like with certain things I had studied that ultimately, like, if a person's bigger and stronger and faster, they're gonna, you know, steamroll you. And Aikido was one of the first things I ever experienced where much smaller people were commandingly overmastering much bigger people. And when Hoist Gracie won that UFC, I mean, it's hard to overstate the impact of that. Like, I mean, if you're interested in these types of things, sure. that rewrote people's sense of what the priorities in martial arts should be. That you had, after that, like, you had to be a grappler. You had to be a jiu-jitsu artist. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't just be like a striker. And they were legend. And I was interested in Japanese studies and Aikido and things like that. So I was, the whole thing of the Gracies and their form of jiu-jitsu was very interested in all that. So I wrote into the script that he's doing breath training with someone in Brazil. And I wrote in parentheses, like Hicks and Gracie, but you like one of the Gracies, but we'll never get them. I think it was in parentheses in the script. And then we found out he was down there and everything. And, you know, it was amazing. Those guys are magicians, you know, they're really, really, like Ricky Jay is to magic, or, you know, Kelly Slater is to surfing. It's like when you're with someone who's got that level of, you know, alpha over everybody else, it's really, really, really neat.
Yeah. For those people listening who don't know who Hicks and Gracie is, it doesn't, of course, cover it completely, but just check out the documentary Choke. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a great introduction to not only Hicks and, but also gives a decent dose of Japanese culture. Now, you spent time in Osaka, is that right? Mm-hmm. Or how long were you there?
I was there for a long summer, between my junior and senior year in college. I had a job over there.
And what attracted you to Asian culture or Japanese culture?
I was interested in, I mean, I wish I could say it was something more evolved than the Richard Chamberlain miniseries of Shogun, but I think it was that.
It's a good miniseries.
I think when I was a kid, I think the Shogun was on. Then that I went and read Clavell's book, and then I, you know, devoured a lot of his Asia sort of historical novels and thought they were really neat. And then it, you know, it kind of grew from there. And then, I became interested in Buddhism, you know, history of Buddhism and stuff like that. And, Japanese aesthetics really appealed to me, and the idea of Zen really captivated me when I was like in my late teens and stuff like that. And that was all just what pulled me into it. And then I love spending time over there and stuff. And then later, you know, and then one of my advisors, one of my professors was one of the great modern Chinese, historians, Jonathan Spence, and he wrote, like, to me, the definitive book about modern Chinese history called The Search for Modern China, and just Death of Woman Wang, To Change China, all these great, great, great books. And he was a phenomenal, he really activated history. You know, he really, like, was one of those people who I thought his lectures were just fantastic. That drew me into that interest.
Why did you decide to major in history?
Because I realized, my freshman year, that I had no natural, Mozart-like talent for math. And so that my dreams of like being Carl Sagan or a great astrophysicist were probably going to be hampered by my poor grasp of even, you know, complex math, let alone like physics. And, so that became a hobby and a passion, but not, you know, and I realized I probably was a humanities major. I've always really liked reading. I've always really, to me, like studying history and travel are almost like the same thing. It's like I having a sense of like, you know, how things became the way they are and how people became the way they are is really interesting to me.
Humans of New York. So I've had quite a few fans ask me to explore this a bit. Can you explain to people how you came to be, what is Humans of New York and how did you come to be involved with it?
I'm not involved with it, to be clear. Sister turned me on to the site. And I think a couple of my friends in New York mentioned it to me, and it just, I liked it. I thought the site was really, I don't even know what to call it, a blog, a portrait series. You know, it's a, it remind, not to be too academic, but there's a great American cultural anthropologist, Studs Terkel, you know, and he, Studs Terkel was like the great chronicler of American working man and the common man kind of, you know, he was the Depression era version of that. And I feel like what this guy's got going with Humans of New York is like a modern day Studs Terkel kind of, thing. And it's just great. If you're a New Yorker or anybody, it's a really, really cool, vantage on just people. And so actually, again, my sister just flipped me, said, have you seen this series he's got going? And, he had just launched this series of profiles that he was calling the Syrian Americans about he'd gone to Turkey to photograph and interview and profile people who were getting asylum, in the US and were coming, you know, as though to say, okay, like let's meet who these people really are and get out of the demagoguery of it all and just sort of see. And you know, if you looked at any of them, they were incredibly, incredibly affecting stories.
And how did that intersect then with CrowdRise?
Well, CrowdRise, just last year, about this time last year, we made the decision to, expand from hosting only, peer-to-peer fundraising projects and crowdfunding projects for registered nonprofits and charities to also letting people raise direct assistance for other people. You know, people who wanted to raise medical costs for a friend who had had an accident or, a friend who'd lost their house. So we decided to support fundraisers with, where people could help friends or loved ones with medical costs, crisis, education costs, tuitions, things like that. And, partly because so many people who use CrowdRise, were asking us that they preferred to keep using their CrowdRise profile pages and mount those types of projects rather than have to go offsite to these, frankly, in my opinion, fairly shitty, exchange utilities, as I call them, like places that are just transactional platforms with no real strategic support, no long-term capture of your personal philanthropic narrative and that charge, in my opinion, way, way, way too much. So because CrowdRise on the charitable, you know, on the charity side had already pioneered kind of mechanisms for delivering donated dollars through at a incredibly reduced rate compared to other platforms. Often we're able to offset even the credit card fees. So, charities were already excited about and benefiting from being able to get their donation dollars through at cheaper than they can on their own websites. And as I was looking at the sites that support direct assistance fundraisers and I was looking at the rates of charge, I was just like, screw this, man. We need to make our pricing model available to people who are trying to help their friends and family. And so we did. I hadn't even used that functionality on our own site. And when I saw that story, I decided I was going to do my first, you know, direct assistance fundraiser to help that family. And if we raised enough to help a couple of the families in the series.
Mm-hmm. And how did the campaign do?
The campaign was tremendous. It raised the first 300,000 in like 30 hours. I mean, it really went fast. And then it climbed toward, I think we're at, you know, 460,000 or something like that across the next day or two. And what's fascinating, I think, just, you know, to give huge credit to Brandon and who's the founder of Humans of New York and the photographer and writer. And we didn't put it out in any kind of CrowdRise social media or mine or anything like that. I set up the page and Brandon posted on Humans of New York, and a huge increment of that was driven in very short order in, I think, donations that averaged $26 or $27 just from the Humans of New York reader base. And then we expanded it. We let some media be done on it and stuff like that. And I think when all is said and done, we'll probably get up to 500,000. But I loved it. You know, I loved seeing that, you know, for the price of three venti frappuccinos, people could, without putting any kind of a dent or making any kind of a stretch in their own capacity, just make the emotional gesture of responding to a story that touched them and demonstrate that in aggregate, if people will do this, you can generate transformative impact, as a crowd. And that's the essence of why we set CrowdRise up. And I think, it was pretty thrilling. Like, we had a lot of people on the CrowdRise staff, and Brandon at Humans of New York. We were all just like, you know, we were all pretty emotional about it. It was really cool to see it unfold. And I think, by the way, again, it really was not a function of anything particular to my public profile at all. It really wasn't. It was driven almost exclusively by the authentic passion of the Humans of New York reader base, who also were responding to the story and just were happy that someone had created the vehicle to all gather around and respond together. And I think that, you know, I think that that's available to all of us. That's what I like about it. I think you and I were talking about this earlier. I think, you know, we're in this very strange time where, like, resource concentration is a real, you know, it's a real thing. Like, people can say whatever they want, but the relative share of national wealth is being held by, in larger and larger increment, by fewer and fewer people. And at the same time, we're cutting, you know, aspects of the social safety net and food stamps, as our friend Tony Robbins points out. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's exciting about the networked world and the sort of the distributed, the empowerment of a distributed culture of people outside of government agencies, outside of corporate constructs, outside of everything, to be able to assemble and rally together, is that people can proactively address things like that. We can move resources without anybody else's say so. We can decide, you know, we can decide that we want to get together around things and assemble resources and make things happen, like, in with incredible speed, like incredible speed. Yeah. And I think that's really, really exciting.
And what you mentioned also, which I think is worth underscoring, part of the reason I've been so excited by crowdfunding of many different types, is, like you said, you can not only affect change, in some cases massive change, with incredible speed, you can do it without any given individual suffering a decrease in their quality of life,
yeah,
or discretionary income or anything else, because yeah, you have just 1,000 tiny movements that build this groundswell that can then sort of get something to escape velocity. And I've had a fantastic experience working with the CrowdRise team. And for those people interested, and you mentioned Tony's also behind this. I think that, you know, depression and sort of the mental health research in the U.S. has a long way to go, and particularly with classic compounds that could be called entheogens, they could be called psychedelics. But I'm working with a team at Johns Hopkins, Roland Griffiths, and we're looking at, or we will be conducting a pilot study using psilocybin for the addressing of treatment-resistant depression. So depression, major depression, that in subjects that has not responded to SSRIs or other types of therapy. And preliminary data would suggest that one dose has a rapid, substantial, and sustained effect, in some cases up to 6 months, with antidepressive effects. And so we'll be not only conducting the administration of the psilocybin, but also using things like functional MRI to track and analyze it, so we can hopefully determine how to safely best administer psilocybin or some analog of that. And what's so cool about it is it takes the study would cost a lot less than people might expect. It's $80,000, and we have a roster of thought leaders from different areas who are in support of this, including Tony. So for people who want to check that out, and also just check out CrowdRise as a platform and see how well the entire page is put together. You can go to crowdrise.com/Tim Ferriss, whether you know how to spell it or not. Any misspelling will probably go to the same place. So crowdrise.com/Tim Ferriss, and I'll link to that in the show notes. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about?
Well, CrowdRise? No, I think I do. I love that we're going to work with you on this, because I also think that, I was having this conversation with Tony Robbins yesterday, because he, like you, has a terrific community of people that rally around the ideas and that you share and pull together and source for people. And I think I do think it's, again, it to me, what you're doing and the notion that it doesn't matter that Tony could write a check for it or you could write a check for it or whatever.
Right.
The notion that you can open up a serious conversation about a blind spot, you know, a blind spot that we've got about, you know, the potential in something, being taken off the table as an opportunity for people because it's going to get, you know, lumped in to a category of drugs viewed as negative, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And it's crazy. But the idea that, you know, there's actually, in many ways, I think there's much more potency in the idea of people of common mind about the rationality of something rallying to the tune of $25 a piece to collectively say, let's make this happen. Like, let's make this happen. We don't need a foundation. We don't need a rich person. We don't need a say so from, the NIH. We're going to make this happen. I think it's like actually kind of like a 21st century expression of, like if you go back and read, de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, you know, he's this French guy visiting America in the 1830s or whatever. And, commenting on like, what is it? Like, he basically, one of the most notable things he says is he goes around and says, like, these people just start organizing. They just get together and get things done is basically what he's saying. He's like, he comments on all the civic groups and all the community organizations and all the trade, you know, he basically is amazed by what self, proactive self organization Americans do. And this is, you know, nearly 200 years ago. And I think, and I love it. I think this is exactly what you're doing, is exactly that. It's like saying, hey, in this forum that you've got, we can get this done. Let's rally together and do it. And I think that's, I think we've only really scratched the surface of the potential in rallying crowds of people around needs, ideas, you know, businesses. It's we're in the earliest infancy still. Maybe not the earliest. People who poo-pooed it at first have now had to acknowledge that it's a force, but I think it's still gonna mature and become an even bigger part of our kind of cultural practice almost.
Oh, I agree. And I think that, you know, the reason, just to build on what you said, the reason that I'm not just, say, funding this one study is that I really believe, having just observed millions of people now on my various outlets and on the blog and so on for almost 10 years, hard to believe. Next year is the 10th anniversary of the first book. It's insane. But is that most people do not attempt great things because they don't believe they can perform or achieve great things. Because I think in part the word great implies something of massive magnitude, that engenders a lot of self-sacrifice. And I think with the technology that we have now, what I want people to experience firsthand is that they can participate, make a very small chess move themselves, say moving that pawn forward one square, that collectively with everyone else doing the same wins the equivalent of like the World Series and puts a real positive dent in the universe. Like with this study, it's a chance for people to become potentially part of history. I mean, it could really be an Archimedes lever in reinventing how we look at treating depression and doing so with fewer side effects. And to do that, participate, even if it's $1, $25, or just say hypothetically $0, but you tell 10 other people about it.
Right.
And in that way, participate.
Well, that's part of what you're talking about in terms of leverage is what it is also, I think, a part of the almost like the philosophical conviction we have at CrowdRise, which is that, people's capacity to affect change is not a function of their financial capacity. It's that everybody in the world we're living in has in a dozen assets they can leverage, that their, you know, their Facebook page, their social networks, their, you know, their friends and family, their schools, their institutions, their companies. Everybody's got networks now. It's not just the Rolodex anymore. It's now there's a mini network effect around everybody and available to everybody. But they have their energy, they have their creativity, they have their passion, and they have their tools now that let so many more people from the comfort of their couch exert their brain, their creativity, without like massive logistical and cost constraints on them. And so we're saying it all the time. Like, you know, it's not even a question of whether you've got even the capacity to donate $25 to a psilocybin study. It's like, if you believe in it, almost everybody can ask 20 friends for $10 and donate 10x their personal capacity. You know, it's like you can do anything that you care about, you actually can affect now. And I think, one of the reasons like we set CrowdRise up as not a kind of a use and drop evaporative platform, but a place where, like a Facebook or a Twitter, it's a permanent staging ground for a certain type of activity that you're doing, is that we think people get proud when they do these things. They're proud to participate. They're proud of the things they've done. And so we give them the opportunity to stage multiple projects over time and capture the aggregate narrative, right, of everything they've done year over year. You know, that's why we'll do this with you. And then you'll do something else and we'll do it again and we'll do it again. And soon it won't just be the individuated success of these projects that sort of evaporate. It'll be like Tim's impact page will show the it'll be a way of looking at the totality of what you've done over time. And I think that's really, really, that's a difference in a true platform versus what I would call just a payment utility.
No, and this to me is, and this has a lot of, for those people who have heard my podcasts with James Fadiman or Dan Engel and Martin Polanc. I mean, these types of compounds have had a huge impact in my life in ways that I couldn't have imagine possible. And so it's less a transaction or even a campaign in my mind than the beginning of a movement. And so I felt like it was the right match.
Yeah, you want stickiness, you know, you want recurrence, you want like a micro platform, turnkey, made easy for you, that becomes something that can sustain, you know.
Do we have some time for a few more questions?
Yeah.
When you hear the word successful, who is the first person who comes to mind and why?
My dad is up there. My dad, my brother, you know, I'm not sure, it's about people who spring to mind so much as that, like, I definitely find, that almost in that childlike way of like role modeling, now in my life, when I meet people who seem like they've got their aspirations and their engagement in balance with a lot of time for contemplative time, family time, personal health, physical health. I tend to look at that and go, wow, like I want to be like that guy or that woman, you know, I definitely have seen more than enough people with success as defined by notoriety or money or whatever, who look like the specter of, you know, despair to me. Like I've seen, as I'm sure you have, like lots of people, you know, with the albatross of success around their neck, that seem like an intense, cautionary tale to me. Like I'd rather, you know, so it's more, my sense of like what constitutes a successful person is probably more defined now by what looks like a healthy person.
How do you prevent yourself from becoming intoxicated by the sort of culture or cult of personality that seems to be so prevalent in the worlds of, say, entertainment, or that obsession with material wealth? I mean, it seems to be that type of albatross seems to be very common. What has helped you to not succumb?
You know, like I think everybody's got to constantly, sort of do battle with like the voices in your head that of ego and, you know, I mean, that's what Birdman was all about. That literally, I think that the beauty of what Alejandro took on in that film was being honest about the degree to which voices in your head, like just hammer at you and hammer at you and hammer at you about what you don't have and what you ought to be aspiring to and, mattering, you know, in the world. And I think that anybody, very few people are really free of that. But I think that, living in New York helps me oddly, just because it's not a film industry town. There's so much going on there and there's so many things I'm interested in and involved in. It keeps my life diverse. And when I'm out here where we are, like I do find that, like, you know, like being in the water and being able to hike, and I'm a pilot, so flying and there's just things that take you out of your, things that take me out of my head help a lot. Are pretty key, but I'm ridiculously fortunate. And I think, I have more than enough. And I think that, sometimes it's even getting a little bit of a taste of how much, like, you know, material possessions can really be a trap. It's like there is that, you know, the things that you own end up owning you kind of maxim. And I think that I do think it's really, really true. I think you start realizing how much lighter you feel when you dispense with a lot of that stuff, then it that becomes a positive snowball, you know?
Mm-hmm. What books or book have you given most as a gift to other people?
That's a good question. There was a period where I really liked Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's book. It's called Wind, Sand, and Stars.
Oh, I haven't read that one.
That's a great, great one.
Were you interested in him because he was a pilot, or did you?
Yeah, both. I was reading a lot of books about flying, but
real innovator in, I guess, what, postal delivery or something.
Yeah. I mean, he was flying the mail from like the Sahara to Paris and from Patagonia to Paris, which is, you know, from,
yeah, that's insane.
I mean, crazy.
For those people who don't recognize the name, also wrote The Little Prince.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, Wind, Sand, and Stars is like, it's as much a book about a philosophy of life as it is, and as it is about flying. It's like Zen in the in the craft of flying. But it's just beautiful. We were talking about this earlier. I really like that book, The Black Swan.
Yeah.
I gave that to friends of a certain type.
what type? I really enjoyed that book.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. I think it's an extremely like, if you absorb it right, it's got a really amazing capacity to prick certain bubbles of delusion or help you realize bubbles of delusion that we all operate in. And it's, I think it's really, really cool.
How not to fool yourself.
Yeah.
You mentioned two essays, and we don't have to go too deep into the, I'll just name them and then link to them in the show notes, but there was Second Wind.
Second Wind, yeah.
Which was by the former Czechoslovakian president. I'm not going to get his first name.
Václav
right.
Havel.
Havel, H-A-V-E-L. And then The Catastrophe of Success, and the author is?
Tennessee Williams.
Any context that you'd like to provide for folks for those two?
Just great. The Catastrophe of Success is like one of the great essays by a creative person about exactly what you're just talking, the traps that follow on achieving anything really that you were aspiring to achieve. And then what happens after that happens, you know, and Second Wind is sort of the same from a different perspective, more like how do you have the courage to kind of, not repeat yourself, put yourself out of your comfort zone, in a creative sense, but also in a life sense I think what I like about Second Wind is as a playwright, he's sort of saying like that you kind of disgorge like a point of view and you can keep doing that. But at some point, if you don't stop and go back into like absorption mode, you're going to be repeating yourself.
Of course,
and you have to dare to like, you have to dare yourself to stop. Listen, live, absorb, and then try again from scratch. You know what I mean? That's like, it's a great essay. It's really, really great.
Do you have any favorite documentaries?
Many. I won't name ones that probably, I love Bennett Miller's film, The Cruise.
The Cruise.
Yeah, Bennett, people know he directed Capote and mm-hmm. Moneyball and Foxcatcher, brilliant filmmaker, but I think almost my favorite film of his is a documentary called The Cruise.
What is that about?
It's about a guy who's a tour. He's a tour guide, host on the open double decker buses in New York City. Who's a poet and who I can't, you can't, you just have to see it.
Okay.
It's great. And I really like that one. Other ones people might not have seen. I really like Adam Curtis's films. Great British documentarian. He's got that 4-part film called The Century of the Self.
Huh.
And then a 3-part one called, The Power of Nightmares. I think those are absolutely brilliant, brilliant, brilliant films. Like, dense, but really eye opening.
Are there any other underrated movies that you think people should say they're not necessarily documentaries? Any particular movies that come to mind for you?
Of late, I think I'm a huge, huge fan of this French filmmaker, Jacques Audiard, who I think in the last few years, he put up a hat trick of films. The Beat My Heart Skipped, and then A Prophet.
That is one of that is one of my favorite films.
Like one of the
amazing.
I personally put A Prophet as one of the three best gangster films ever made.
So
like,
good.
I think
oh my
for
God.
Me, The Godfather,
okay.
Goodfellas, and A Prophet are at this point my three. If I had to pick three gangster films, I think they're the best ones.
If for those people who haven't seen A Prophet, it's I don't speak French, but I guess it's Un Prophète, and the poster, if you're looking at it on Netflix or Amazon or iTunes or whatever, it's sort of red and black. but it's about, I want to say a Middle Eastern.
Algerian.
Yeah. That's right. Algerian, young male who goes to prison and about his
what happens.
Ascension.
Yeah, don't say
oh my
more.
God. I won't say anything more.
And then after that, Rust and Bone was his next film. And it's like, it's just a brilliant film. Marion Cotillard. It's like one of the great performances, in the last few years. And I love those, all those films. And I think, you know, excusing the fact that I happen to be in one of them, but I think Alejandro Iñárritu's last three films in a row, Beautiful was an extremely, extremely underseen masterpiece. It was Iñárritu's film prior to Birdman, and it's a masterpiece.
It's just called Beautiful.
Yeah, spelled wrong. It's a masterpiece, and it's absolutely brilliant. And again, one of the greatest performances of in a long time. And his, the third in his triptych, I think, is The Revenant out right now. I think The Revenant's one of the great films I've seen in the last many years. It's like, it's an absolute unqualified masterpiece. It's like a Native American spirit myth or straight out of a Joseph Campbell myth or something. It's just a magnificent, magnificent piece of filmmaking.
We could have a whole separate conversation about Birdman, which we won't do today, but also one of my favorite films in the last few years. Three more questions. If you could have a billboard anywhere that said anything, what would you put on it?
I might put Pray for Surf. I don't know. I might put the name of certain people from high school, like, and just say like so-and-so comma, how you like me now. No, that would be very unevolved. That would be very, very unevolved. I don't know. I don't know what I would put on it.
We can come back to that too.
I'm changing my answer. I would put Paul Rudd's cell phone number, on it. It would complete a long running, series of jokes that would just be perfect.
Okay. I would say, see if we can
Paul Rudd's actual number, please call.
We'll do a separate crowdfunding campaign to raise money for the billboard rental. What advice would you give to your 30-year-old self, and could you displace where you were at the time?
Oh yeah, I know. I was on the last 2 days of shooting a film I was directing when I turned 30, and I might tell myself at that phase to commit myself to a few fewer things than I did at that time that I'm still feeling obligated to, and that maybe I wish I had a few less of those things. Like I think my aspiration and my sense of my own energy and time was like limitless at that time. And now, some of that has become a cage of obligation that I would like to,
unlock.
Yeah. But I'll get there.
Senior year in college, what advice would you have given yourself?
I might have told myself to go live abroad right then. I should have done it right then, like for a year or two. I had lived abroad a little bit. I should have gone in. That's like when you think everything's about to get started and it's not. And I should have gone somewhere, you know, interesting or different that I would be much harder to do later.
Where would you choose for yourself?
I don't know.
No,
I don't know.
Should take a trip to Japan together, get you back to Japan. Last real question is, do you have any ask or request of the audience, people listening, things they should do ponder or otherwise?
If you're gonna, if you're looking to raise financial support for a friend or family member, do it on CrowdRise, not on other sites, because much more of the money will go through to them. That's my, you know, entrepreneurial hat. And then, I think, I'd say, and I'm not even joking, I think like, you know, stay tuned into communities like this. I think these things are really cool. I think, you know, maybe in a sim, put sim, put more simply, like just participate, you know, in some, what I think's cool about what you've assembled is I think it's driven by people's desire to like, not hack life, but be proactive and participate and not be apathetic. And I like that. I think that's a positive community. And I think we all get really tired. You know, I think modern life is stressful and tiring and confusing. And I think it's, you know, Nietzsche has that great thing, that idea of self-overcoming, of like that the overman is not like a perfect person. It's actually the person who's perpetually trying to, self-overcome. And I really like that idea. I think staying engaged in the idea of evolving yourself is really cool. So I think it's awesome that you've got this many people kind of, linked up together around those ideas.
Yeah. I really hope people listening, no matter how small you might feel or isolated you might feel, I know not everyone out there has a community like, you or I might have in New York or SF, you know, make this year the year that you astonish yourself with what you can do or be a part of. And, you know, look back on December 31st of this year and just say, hope to say, holy shit, I can't believe I was part of X, or I did X to yourself, because I think it's a lot easier than people might think. Edward, where can people find you on the interwebs, on social, to say hello? Keep up to date with what you're involved with.
I'm not great at it. I throw tweets out now and then, mostly about things I've seen that I like you were talking about, things I've seen or read that I think should find a wider audience or that people will appreciate.
What is your handle on Twitter?
Just my name.
Okay.
But I'm not cutting edge on, I'm not as cutting edge, I am on the crowdfunding stuff, but I'm not as cutting edge with social media as I maybe should be. Or I don't know, maybe it's a good thing.
Probably means you've melted less of your brain.
Yeah. I think about it, you know, I think about expanding on, you know, more robust ways of kind of doing like what you're doing in a much smaller way, but building up more of a forum of interactive conversation. But I gotta finish things I started.
Might be a cage within a cage.
Yeah, exactly. I gotta finish things I started.
This is always fun. I enjoy hanging out, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Definitely, it's no, super fun. I've really enjoyed your books. I've enjoyed the kind of I've enjoyed them as a resource, and I think learned a lot, and I think I really do think it's cool that what you've cultivated is people who are interested in continuing to explore, you know, I think it's that idea, ongoing education, ongoing discoveries, that's the zest in things.
Yeah. You don't necessarily find yourself. You create yourself one little step at a time. So Edward, thank you again. And to everyone listening, check out crowdrise.com/Tim Ferriss to see what mischief, productive mischief I'm getting up to. And as always, you can find the show notes, links to everything we talked about, 4hourworkweek.com/podcast. And until next time, thank you for listening.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is Five Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And Five Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.